Hey folks, Rob Wolf here. The Wait is Over, Wired to Eat is now available anywhere books are sold. You can check it out also at wiredtoeat.com. Hey folks, six listeners can't be wrong. It's another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Today's guest is Mark Bell. Mark has the infamous distinction of being picked as one of the 30 best gyms in America by Men's Health March 2008, and NorCal Strength and Conditioning was similarly picked, which shows that there is absolutely no quality control or vetting in any of these things. Mark runs the Super Training Gym. He runs the PowerCast podcast. And Mark, you are an elite-ranked powerlifter at more than one weight class. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, you know, I got to use the word was because I'm retired.
Right.
From competitive powerlifting, from getting my ass up on the platform again. But I competed from 181 pounds all the way up to super heavyweight and then worked my way back down over the years.
And how tall are you?
I'm 6 feet if I'm lucky.
On a
tall day when the gravity is not that big, I'm about 6 feet.
Okay, so you're a little taller than I am. I competed mainly at 181 and then made one foray to 198, but it was all I did was lift weights and have bowel movement. So I had to give that one up. My frame was not really meant to carry that. So yeah.
Hey, you have all sorts of stomach problems all the time, don't you? Or you used to anyway?
I used to. And, you know, it's funny. I kind of wonder sometimes if trying to stuff 6,000 calories a day down my pie hole for like 15 or plus years might have set me up for some other problems. But it was really a super bad case of Giardia when I went to Mexico and I came back and like all the gluten intolerance and dairy intolerance and all that stuff. It had always been kind of low level looking back, but after I had the trots for almost 3 months from that and finally figured out that I had a parasite living in me, then it was a long time getting back on track after that.
Giardia sounds like the next step after diarrhea.
It is the final step. It's basically the final exit. It's like the Hemlock Society of GI problems. Like you're pretty much going to die from it. So yeah, it was amazing.
Damn.
Hey, Mark, what drew you to powerlifting initially? Like, I had a youth football injury. I had a bruised spine and a whiplash, which was pretty severe. Could have been really bad. And as part of the recommended rehab I had out of that from the neurosurgeon that worked with me, he turned me on to a couple of folks that you might know, Danny Thurman and some of his friends. And so they got me on a neck rehab program. And they found that I maybe had a little bit of aptitude in the squat and deadlift. My bench was always pretty laughable, but found a little aptitude with that and a lot of enjoyment. But what drew you into powerlifting?
I started taking anabolic steroids when I was 10 years old, and I needed something to funnel all that energy. All that extra testosterone needed somewhere to go, so I started powerlifting.
It was before MMA, so you didn't have that as an option. So,
yeah, that's right. Now, you know, it's kind of a natural progression into powerlifting, you know, playing football and stuff growing up, and my brothers and I loving professional wrestling and stuff like that. We all kind of wanted to try to figure out a way to get bigger, but my path, I guess, is a little bit similar to yours, where it wasn't me that had the injuries and stuff. It was my brother, Chris. Mm-hmm. My brother, Chris, had some problems with his knees, so he had a double knee surgery. And when he had surgery on his knees and he was, you know, coming back, he went to a chiropractor, and the chiropractor happened to squat like 750 pounds. And he said, you know, the only way that you're going to live pain free is to combat it with being strong. And we're going to have to get you doing some squats. And so my brother started squatting with a broomstick and worked his way up to while still being in high school, squatting like 675 pounds or something crazy like that. And then, you know, it basically became part of our life from there. I kind of have your typical kid being picked on story of, you know, I was throwing around a football one day. I was always playing by myself. I was throwing this football up in the air and pretend I'm catching the game-winning touchdown as I was doing all the time. And my brother's friend, who we knew the family, and there were people that we didn't get along with great. And he was like, "Hey, Bell, throw me the football." So it's like, oh, this is a lot better than playing by myself, you know, but this guy's an asshole. And so I do throw the ball to him and he catches it. He's in a tank top, by the way, with super tight acid wash jeans on. The tank top is tucked into the acid wash jeans very tightly. He has just a wicked mullet going on and a mustache that he probably had since he was about 13. He turns around and takes my favorite New York Jets football and punts it into the woods. And he was like 5 or 6 years older than me. And so I just kind of felt like I couldn't do anything about it. And he was actually, he had some muscle on him and stuff. I think he was already working out at that time. And I just remember kind of feeling like helpless. Like I felt like I couldn't do anything about that situation. And so I was like, you know what? I need to figure out a way that that never happens to me again. And so you can cut to a Rocky montage of me working out in the garage and training ever since that point, pretty much.
That's awesome. When you started describing him, I thought you were going to say that you threw the football to Patrick Swayze, but it minus the mustache. I don't remember him ever rocking a mustache.
It's very similar to Patrick Swayze. It's more Patrick Swayze with like a perm.
Okay.
Would be Patrick Swayze with like, you know, the straight combed hair, you know?
Right, right. Hey, Mark, I know prehab and rehab is just a big part of the whole system that you use. You guys are definitely well steeped in the West Side Barbell scene. I'm going to hit you up for some free advice here, at least, so I had a back injury, L4, L5 flexion injury, in my early CrossFit days. One day I did, my first exposure to glute ham sit-ups. I did 75 of them and ended up with abdo, cause I had a nice safe, you know, ramp up on the exposure.
What was that like? That must have been awful.
Oh, it was horrible. It was absolutely horrible.
Your whole stomach like swell up and stuff?
It swelled up and like it was almost like the diastasis steel that women have when they have pregnancy, you know, where like the muscle fibers are just separating apart and everything. And
that's crazy.
Yeah. It was maybe 12 or 15 days later, we were pulling some max deadlifts and I got right about my knee, right above the knee, and I believe because my abs were still basically like a sweater that had been, you know, hit with a shotgun blast and not really networked up the way they're supposed to be, I just failed. And like I had never failed under a lift like that. Like it either went up or it didn't go up. I had never had any type of, you know, flexion deal. I worked as a physical therapy aide for years, and I made fun of the people that had back injuries because they would sweat and you know, like the amount of pain that they were, you know, suggesting that they experienced. I had and seen compound fractures that hurt less than what they were showing. And the karma came back around because I couldn't stand up for the better part of a week. I had this like lateral shift to the right, you know, my SI joint was all tweaked and I've made progress over the years, but I've found that any type of unilateral loading, squatting or regular deadlifting, I can straight leg deadlift okay. I can front squat okay because I'm really in that nice extended position. But those are weighted hip bridges are kind of my go-to for heavier lower body loading at this point. Like regular back squats, regular deadlifts aren't all that good of a go. I do a lot of reverse hypers, back extensions, oblique work. Am I just screwed? Like, is that just kind of the state of affairs, or do I need to go down to super training and have you do an assessment on me and figure out what we could do? What are your thoughts around all that?
It would be great to have you at super training because I can take you through a bunch of different things. But, you know, I think you have to kind of figure out, you know, what the goal is and then kind of like why, you know, do you want to deadlift 4 plates just because it's cool and just because you want to like pick it up and feel good? Or is there some other type of goal there? Do you want to get on a platform and compete? So it really kind of depends on what we're talking about. If we're talking about, you know, building the kind of strength necessary for like a powerlifting meet or something, then things have to be taken to the extreme and there's going to be risk of injury. I know you do a lot of jiu-jitsu and even with you guys being careful with each other, there's going to be, you're going to tweak stuff here and there, especially, as you go up the ranks, and especially as you start to compete more intensely and stuff. So there's really absolutely no way to avoid kind of heavy loading if you're going to power lift. However, if you don't really care that much and you're just looking to increase some muscle mass and get stronger, you certainly don't have to deadlift until you're blue in the face to accomplish that. And so utilizing other exercises, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. You said you do the heavy glute bridges and stuff like that. Things where your spine isn't going to have a lot of loading mm-hmm. are going to be things that are the most favorable. And some things load the spine differently, like a farmer's carry is a lot safer to do than something like a deadlift. A regular deadlift with a regular barbell automatically shifts that bar out in front of you, and just you can get into some compromising positions. It's hard to maintain proper form and technique throughout the entire range of motion. What I'd ultimately say is that a little bit goes a long way, and so could get you to the point where you can do some deadlifting once a week or several times a month, 2 to 3 times a month, that would be sufficient. And even with weights that aren't real significant, I think you can get a lot out of using a little. And there's so many different ways to actually lift the weight that we could work on pauses in certain positions, which, you know, you can kind of argue that the pauses coming out of certain positions could help you with your jiu-jitsu because it could help you defend against certain movements, because static positions and kind of coming out of some of those static positions are going to be really crucial to the movement of MMA or the movement of jiu-jitsu, stuff like that. So really it's a matter of, like, you know, what do we really need this for? Figure out what we need this for. What do we need these deadlifts for? And then we make a game plan from there. But main thing is just being able to control spinal loading. You know, you start to squat often, you start to deadlift often, and really just starting to kind of mix in a nice recipe for disaster. There's so many other forms of strength that we could be playing with. We could be pushing a sled or pulling a sled or doing farmer's carries are a great movement, yoke walks. There's a lot of different ways that we can load the spine or even not load the spine using something like a belt squat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Belt squat would really be fantastic. And then also you have just lat work, just working your lats and working your back is going to help your entire back from the neck down. So things like reverse hyperextensions are great. You got 45 degree back raises. So as I preach all the time, focus on what you can do and try not to focus on what you can't do.
Perfect. Cool. That's phenomenal. It's still hard to, it's hard to come to terms with sometimes, because it was almost an identity associated with, being able to roll into the gym and with no warm up, throw 3 plates on, go ass to ankles with that. And, you know, but I also did stuff like that from the age of 13 till about 35. And
yeah,
that's a pretty good run. And, you know, it's interesting because the unilateral loading, like you said, the farmer's walks and everything, I just had a kind of a modified wheelbarrow made where I can just load plates on the wheelbarrow and you know, it's super stout and I can wheel that around, and that stuff feels really good. And in jiu-jitsu, I've never have issues with strength. I still get beat on technicality. I've got my cardio up to a spot where I typically don't gas, but it's, you know, it's never or very, very rarely a strength issue unless somebody's like 40 or 50 pounds heavier than I am. And I just get, you know, out muscled in that regard, but that helps a ton. And a lot of it is just kind of that psychological factor of, man, I feel like I should be squatting and deadlifting.
Are you able to squat and deadlift right now?
Yeah, but very light on the back squat, quite light on the deadlift. And interestingly, if I do straight leg deadlifts or RDLs, I have really comparatively low problem with that. But, you know, a regular back squat, I will tend to get kind of a lateral SI joint shift after that, and then I start getting some crankiness in the disc. And if I can get ahead of it, I can usually shut it down. But if I don't get ahead of it, say like I have to travel that day or I go to jits that day and I get it a little bit tweaked, then it could be a week and a half or a 2 week deal of being pretty compromised.
You'll get a kick out of this. So there's something that's called strength aerobics, which is basically just lifting very slowly. I would be interested to kind of see what that would do for you, using sets of anywhere between, I guess, 8 to about 12 reps, and using a good 6-second count on the way down. Probably be more effective in your squats than it would be in the deadlift. In the deadlift, it's really punishing, and you'd have to go insanely light. Strength aerobics can be super beneficial to help repair tissue. There's a lot of evidence pointed to it, and it's, for some reason, it's something that's just been kind of swept under the rug. People don't pay much attention to it, but it's been around for this from the time of like the 60s or so, and people have utilized it for years. So give that a try. You know, do a 6-second count on the way down, and maybe just about a 3 on the way up. Use some really light weights and try, 3 sets of about 8 reps, and then the level of intensity that I would associate with it, given the fact that you have some pre-existing injuries, would only be like on a scale of 1 to 10, you would be looking between like a 5 and a 7 would be about as far as you'd want to take that. You'd want the execution of all of those lifts to be perfect. You want every rep to be perfect and for you to have a neutral spine on every single one of them. The other suggestion would be to do partial range of motion deadlifting, get doing a rack pull or having the weights elevated a little bit off the ground. That bottom position of a deadlift is just a real bitch. There's no other way of putting it. It just kind of sucks. So if you can get yourself, again, you're probably not looking to go to like a meet and really like hit some huge deadlift. So why not use some partials and stuff? And then lastly, the other thing you can do is just kind of think about like where you've been, like what you've been doing lately. And you, over the period of time, you can just ramp the intensity up just a tiny bit. I think we all have a tendency to be in such a rush with everything. And so if you're not really doing that much and you're not really pushing on the gas pedal all that hard, then you just want to just briefly push on the gas pedal a little bit harder. And you want to get in and out of some of this stuff as if it's a fight. You don't want to spend 45 minutes on a squat. You want to spend, once you're warm, you want to spend about 8 minutes on a squat and then get the fuck away from that thing as quick as you can, because barbell exercises are fantastic because they're barbell exercises, but they're also detrimental because they're barbell exercises and they can be overdone. So get in, get out, stick and move.
Okay. I like it. I like it. My usual workouts are, I've been doing a 2-day-a-week split. I do some upper body and some lower body on the same day. I usually do, a vertical press, vertical pull, hip dominant one day, a horizontal press, horizontal pull, quad kind of dominant thing on the second day. Usually some higher intensity on each one of, from day to day. But usually the whole session from warm up to wrap up is about 20, 25 minutes. So I usually click through it pretty quick.
Yeah, and you're looking pretty jacked lately, by the way.
It's kind of funny. Less has been more for me. It's pretty interesting, and just really trying to chase that consistency. You know, it's interesting, though. You mentioned the strength aerobics. I had a pretty strong early influence from Fred Hatfield and his compensatory acceleration. And so I've always been in that mode of just trying to accelerate the bar, or even if I'm doing gymnastics movements, I usually do it in a way where it's the loading is such that I've got a really good acceleration element to it. But, it is interesting. I noticed that when I'm called upon to do slower movements, even in jiu-jitsu and stuff like that, I get kind of shaky. Like, I think I've maybe wired up my nervous system to just always be like, all on or all off. So this strength aerobic stuff would be pretty interesting because I've never done training like that.
Yeah, think about, how many people have you talked to that have been injured from walking?
Not too many.
and then take that just a step further and just walk really slow. Older folks, they walk really slow for a reason. I'm sure they don't want to walk that slow, but they're in a lot of pain. And so the slower movement is going to be a more careful movement, and it's going to be a movement where you can actually be connected. You can be a lot more connected to the bar. Your mind can be connected to the bar a lot better. if I said, Rob, you're coming to super training and, you know, it's time that you just fucking step shit up and we're going right to 405, no belt. I just want to see you just smash it. We're going to put on your favorite music and we're going to get you hyped up and we're have everybody yelling and screaming and we're just going to get after it. Well, you know, that would be a great opportunity for an injury.
Right.
And also, what are you thinking about when you do that lift? You're not really thinking about much of anything, probably, other than just like being aggressive. Like you're probably trying to talk yourself into it. You're trying to hype yourself up. And you're not really thinking so much about the form and technique. Whereas if you have, you know, just 95 pounds on the bar and you're doing 6 seconds on the way down and 3 on the way up, every single rep is taking nearly 10 seconds. You can think, okay, as I go down, I'm going to force my knees out and I'm going to, as I go towards the ground more, I'm not going to allow my chest to fall towards the floor. I'm going to try to pick my chest up, keep my chin up. You get to talk to yourself mm-hmm. You're doing the lift. And even better, like if you have a coach or you have somebody that trains with you or even just a training partner, you can get a lot more coaching cues done that way. And then on top of that, the hypertrophy gains that you get from it are awesome. But in my opinion, to be strong, I think that it's important to lift both ways. I think it's important to lift fast and lift slow. And I think it's also important that, you know, you're getting a lot of time under tension under the bar and that you're also doing lifts that only last 6 to 8 seconds, which would just be single rep maxes.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Hey, Mark, when you describe this, it's kind of reminiscent of what I've seen and read about with occlusion training. Have you played around with that much?
Yeah, occlusion training is brutal, but I would say that this feels about the same, especially when you're doing your repetitions. A friend of mine, James Smith, is the one that made me aware of this type of training because I've had, you know, multiple injuries to my pecs and to my elbow and this and that over the years. And so he's the one that kind of turned me onto it. But the burn that you get is just unbelievable. And the way that he would set stuff up for me, I would look at what was written on the paper. And by the way, a percentage associated with this type of lifting, if you're going to do like sets of 10, I would say like go 30-40%, mm-hmm. you know, from the time you try it. That might even feel kind of heavy, but he had written out like on a deadlift, it's like 185 pounds and it was like 18 reps. And I was like, 185 pounds. I wonder why he like prescribed that. I know I'm coming off an injury, but I was like, that's just really, really light. You know, I guess I'll give it a try and see what happens. And it was like, I think it was 6 seconds on the way down and 6 seconds on the way up or something crazy like that. And I was dying. It'll tap into your lungs big time too. You'll be breathing like crazy from it. So definitely recommend it. Give it a shot. I'm not saying that that's the way to train all the time because, you know, people get confused. You know, if I say one thing, then they're like, they'll harp on that one deal. Kind of like yourself when you came out with the paleo solution, everyone thought it was the zero carb diet.
Right.
You're promoting that even CrossFitters and stuff don't eat any carbohydrates. And it's like, I never found any information that where Rob really said not to eat any carbohydrates with the suggestions you were making. Then also people took it out of context too. And they forget the fact that you were very sick and you were trying to figure out a cure for yourself. And so a lot of times people will take some of the information that, that we give and they'll twist it into their own thing, you know?
Right. No. And I mean, the black or white, all or nothing thing is super easy. And trying to figure out shades of gray is kind of an art and science. And I mean, this is where you guys are kind of masters at this kind of micro to mesocycle periodization. Can you talk a little bit about how you slice and dice that? And I know it's like so incredibly individual. And that's part of the reason why what you guys do is so unique. It's not a cookie cutter one size fits all deal. You've got a big basket of tools and you're very adept at using those at the appropriate time. But, you know, how do you as a coach know when to shift somebody from one strength or metabolic characteristic to another? I mean, do you have kind of a game plan or are you doing that intuitively as time goes along?
Yeah, I'd say it's pretty intuitive. What works for our team normally works for a lot of the people that we deal with. So I know people like to try to say that things are like real customized, but I don't really believe that much. I think we are all different, and one person is going to respond a little differently to something than the next. But I think in the beginning that we all have to try similar things, such as doing 3 sets of 10 and such as using machines and stuff to develop some coordination before we do, you know, before we just jump into like a full on like powerlifting or Olympic lifting program. I think it makes some sense to deal with some resistance in some different ways. But in general, what I'm usually doing because of the type of athletes that I work with is I'm normally just trying to hold people back. Mm-hmm. I'm normally trying to give them an assessment of, you know, okay, like you hit a PR, you just got that 10-pound PR. And as I was talking earlier about sticking and moving, I don't think there's a great reason to go for a 30-pound PR today, even though it does look like it's there. I think we get the hell out of here and we count that as a victory and we celebrate that. And we work on the next stuff to work on rather than just trying to go heavier and fail. And so trying to promote success over and over again and seeing people do the lift the right way. If I said, you know, hey, I want you to do 225 for 5 sets of 5. Somebody might be like, 225, like that's pretty light. Like, can I do more? And I said, well, you know, has there ever been a time where you did 25 reps, 5 sets of 5, did all 25 reps? Have you ever done that before where all 25 reps were perfect? If not, then shut the hell up and go do it, you know? So it's you, and you know full well, I like, you know, the reference back to like jiu-jitsu. I've done some jiu-jitsu in my time, and it's been so long. I don't have the repetitions in me because I didn't do enough of them back then to remember how to do some of the locks and stuff and how to do some of the holds. So it would be restarting for me all over again. And if you showed me how to do some moves and stuff, you would show me slowly, mm-hmm. and we'd go over it again and again and again and again until it starts to get kind of ingrained into your system. And strength training is 100% the same. And for some reason, it's always been viewed differently. People always say training. I'm going in and I'm training. Well, training should be synonymous with the word practice because that's what we're really trying to do. You're trying to practice, but they're not. Training has become an event, which it shouldn't be. Training should be training. It should be training for and towards something. It's not an event, which is way different. You know, I myself am totally 100% guilty of that. You know, just watch some of the videos of me doing some of those big benches, and I got some epic music playing. It's fucking blasting. My teammates are yelling and screaming. I'm yelling and screaming. I'm getting chalk all over the place, and I'm super fired up. You're lifting. Your exercise probably shouldn't be that way. You're lifting, right. And your exercise should probably be more routine. And just so that you're not blowing everything out all in one day, as I'm saying, it shouldn't really be an event. It should be more treated as practice.
It took me so long to figure that out, and that's where Danny Thurman and Rich Wood, like, they would see me training, and they had a prescription for me. And, you know, a week or so would go by, and they're like, you are not even remotely following the program, because I would have my – you know, music cranked up and I'm headbutting the bar and have blood dripping down my nose. And they're like, no, no, no. But it was crazy to me how almost inconsequential the training load was in the off season. Like, it was not a huge amount of volume initially, and then the volume would ramp up, but the intensity was still pretty low. And then, you know, when we would start getting 6 weeks, 8 weeks out from a meet, then the repetitions would drop, the total set number would increase, and then we would, you know, dial everything up to, and this was old kind of linear periodization, but it took me a long ways doing that. But it was shocking to me how much less I did, but yet how much more I got out of the training program versus if I just left it, you know, just left my guts in the gym every single training session. Like, I went nowhere. I went backwards, if anything.
There's so many different ways to lift the weight. You know, look at somebody like Kai Greene. you know, a top bodybuilder, Phil Heath. You know, if we were to work out with Phil Heath, we'd find that on many of the exercises in the gym, he uses the same weight as some females probably use that are strong. And you'd be like, huh? You know, this is Phil Heath, like seven-time Mr. Olympia champion. And he's like 250, and he's just a big giant ball of muscle. He's just enormous. But there's so many different ways to lift the weight, and there's so many different ways to get stimulus from those weights. You could use 60%, and you can blast through some dynamic effort work where you're, you know, trying to go as fast as possible. Or you can even implement other things such as bands or chains or pause squats, or you can pause in multiple spots during the lift. You can use a slow eccentric. I mean, the list of variation that you can do goes on and on. And so I think that people kind of lose sight of what's important. And what's the most important thing is that you get in a lot of quality work. And it's hard to get quality work in at 90% and above, mm-hmm. even above 80% can be difficult. So you want to try to find percentages that are heavy enough to promote change, and they're heavy enough to help you make progress, but they're not so heavy that you can't recover from them. I think in an ideal situation, I think pretty much anyone who's listening to this right now would probably train with upwards of 10%, maybe even 15% less than they normally do. They probably will feel pretty recovered and pretty refreshed from all their workouts. And as long as they don't have a meet within the next few weeks, I guarantee you they would get stronger. The only issue that you sometimes run into is when the weights start to become a little bit too light, they become foreign to you. And when you go to pick up something heavy, you go, oh, fuck.
Right.
So you need a little bit of polish, and you need a little bit of that. But that, to me, that only takes the last 2-3 weeks or so. Doing small amounts of overload work, you know, walking out of the rack with a heavy weight, doing some rack deadlifts or some heavy shrugs, or using something like a slingshot on the bench, you know, some form of overload work, can really help as well. I think we're all lifting. Most of us are lifting too often. Most of us are lifting too heavy. And, I think that we could be a lot stronger if we were to spread fatigue out more and kind of not be so impatient with our lifting.
Sure,
and
sure.
Fitness.
Oh, it totally makes sense. And, you know, on that recovery side, do you use HRV or anything like that to kind of help monitor folks? Or what's your process with that?
I've never used the heart rate variability thing, but I would love to get into some of that. I know a lot of people have had a lot of success with that. Recovery-wise, I just basically try not to lift like an idiot. I think that's where everything starts. I think people have a hard time understanding the origin of where things come from. And so in today's day and age where things are moving so fast and we're on our way to the gym and we're like, oh, fuck, I forgot, you know, I need to 400 milligrams of caffeine to get through a training session. And so you stop off at a gas station and down some Red Line and get all fired up and go hit your workout. Well, if you're really training and you're really trying to make progress, your pre-workout starts the night before. And in some situations, your pre-workout starts sometimes weeks in advance. When I used to see some of the stuff that I would program for myself, or occasionally I'd have another coach step in and program something for me. When I saw those weights written out on paper, or when I had an idea of what it was I was going to do, that's where the pre-workout started. That's where conversation started with myself. Like, we're going to go in there and we're going to fucking do this. Like, this shit's going to be hard. I see what's written out and this is intimidating as fuck, but I'm going to go in the gym and I'm going to make this happen. And I think when you talk to yourself that way, at least it works that way for me. When I have some good positive self-talk, the night before, like, hey, you're not going to hit the snooze button. You're not going to go back to bed. You're not just going to snuggle up with the wifey and maybe try to get a piece. You're going to wake the fuck up when you're supposed to, and you're going to get your ass to start working. And I just, to me, that's always helped. That's always that positive self-talk and reinforcement has always helped kind of launch me into, you know, these grueling workouts that we sometimes put ourselves through.
No, that sounds brilliant. There's definitely some interesting kind of feed forward element to little bites of success. So just even setting yourself up for, okay, I'm going to get out of bed at this time. I'm going to do this. My warm up's going to go this way. And so each one of those things is a little bite of success, and you get that little dopamine hit from it. Everything starts moving along. So that kind of pre-planning is powerful.
How do you get yourself to do some stuff like writing is a pain in the ass. So how do you, like you've written some awesome books at this point.
It's funny. I definitely figured out that earlier in the day is where my creativity lies. And I know that's different for people, but if I really have a legit project, like the last book, I was out of the house sometimes at 5:30 and in the office at 6:00. And then I would write from 6:00 until maybe 9:00, sometimes 10 a.m. But like 2.5 to 4 hours of legit writing is it. Like that's all I've got. And I feel kind of like a pussy because I know people do legitimate like 8 and 10 hour days. But, you know, I could answer email after that. I could do some other kind of low level things. But that really good writing for me happens early. And so I just had to be disciplined. I had to get into bed early, get up, get the cup of coffee, eat some protein, right, and then just kind of get that stuff knocked out. And I just discovered that if I punted until the afternoon, the writing was terrible. Mm-hmm. It was 5 times slower. Like it really wasn't worth doing. So the real key for me was finding the time of the day where I was the most productive, and nothing else mattered. Like short of the house burning down, like I was going to get in there, get the writing done. And you know, it's funny, the writing platform I use, it's called Scrivener. It has this little window where you can set a daily word goal, and it starts off red, and then it goes yellow, and then it gets, and then it turns green. Yeah. And it's funny, like there were so many times where I just wanted to quit, but I was like, fuck man, I'm only 500 words away. And like, I would write. And then I would get that ding. And then I would write, you know, maybe 500 more words. Cause I was super excited about that. So it's kind of funny. Like those things sound kind of cheesy, but I guess the two big things is I found my most productive time. And then I had some little tools like they have in Scrivener where I would set a daily word goal and just knock that thing out. And I really do like writing. Like when I'm able to sit down and get into it, I thoroughly enjoy it. It's a lot more enjoyable than cruising around social media, but I still have to whore myself to a certain degree. So I've got to shake hands and kiss babies and do all that stuff. So I still do it.
And so you're mentioning, you know, like, you know, just a 2 to 4 hour window or so of success for yourself with writing. And that plays right back into just what we were talking about in the original question that you had, which was about recovery. You're allowing yourself to recover by only writing a certain amount. You're allowing your brain and your body to recover from, you know, that kind of stuff's actually super stressful. Mm-hmm. Even getting interviewed and stuff, you don't realize how, or interviewing somebody, a lot of the podcast stuff that we do, it's really fun. And it's unbelievable to have the opportunity to do these things, but holy shit, you do a couple of them in a day and
you're knackered afterwards.
Yeah. You're super tired to go to one of these trade shows and you know, be on your feet for a few hours and talk to some fans and some people that have admired your work and stuff, and you're dead, you know.
Yeah.
But you know, with recovery with us, I mean, we use any and everything we possibly can, you know, when it comes to actual stuff that we're using in the gym. I mean, we'll use a lot of the methods from Kelly Starrett, mobilitywad.com, a lot of different stretching and warm-up type stuff. For myself, you know, it's usually, you know, I'm trying to be efficient with what I'm doing. So I'm a big fan of utilizing some other exercises to get a little bit warm for the movement itself, because if I'm to do some drills in the gym, and I'm going to do some like high knee work and just walking, you know, just taking a step and bringing that knee up above the hip and then getting up on the back toe, just doing almost like a little skip type thing. If I do movements like that and do some hip mobility stuff before I even get into my workout, maybe I throw on the hip circle and do some exercise with that. Maybe I squat onto a bench a few times, do some arm circles, just some real general calisthenics. my brain and my body start to really get focused in on that workout. And again, that's where I can take the time to have some good positive self-talk. Like today, here's the intent of the day. Here's the goal. Here's what I want to do. You know, don't forget to have fun. Don't forget to help other people. Don't forget to be courteous and kind, because all those things come back to you. But you have some time in that little time frame to think of those things, because it's very slow and it's very deliberate in what you're doing. And then you can also, if you're doing like toe touches or something like that, you can pause for a second and go, holy shit, the fuck is that in my right hamstring? What's happening back there?
Right.
What the hell did I do last night? You know? And so you can address that, though. You can be like, okay, there's something is just weird with my right leg. I don't know what happened, but I need to address that now, and I'm going to foam roll or whatever the hell it is that you want to do to address the situation, rather than getting underneath the squat bar and being like, oh, man, holy shit, is it going to be a long day? I'm supposed to do 8 sets of this shit today? God damn. And it's all negative reinforcement. And then you get grumpy.
Right.
You know, I don't know about, you know, you or some of the people listening to this podcast, but holy shit, if I'm in pain, I get grumpy. I get real pissy and bitchy to be around. So it's not pleasant. But, you know, in the warm up is where you can kind of assess how your body's feeling for the day. And then recovery wise, you know, I do hot tub, I do cold therapy. I have a pool and a hot tub at my house. And so sometimes I'll go back and forth between the two. I like the hot tub a lot more than getting in the cold pool.
Me too.
And I probably do that a lot more often. I also have a product called the Freeze Sleeve, which is just a really easy product to put on it. It's like a knee or elbow sleeve. You keep it in your freezer and you just slide it on. And it's cold. And I'm a proponent of cold therapy. I know there's been, you know, conflicting, you know, information that has kind of bounced around, but I've always gotten some use out of it. I've always felt pretty good with it, so I utilize that. I'll get massages occasionally. I found that the massages, though, weren't really they didn't seem like they were doing a ton for me. I think I would probably get more benefit from having somebody manually try to like stretch me more than I would have a lot of success with regular massage. But I also get active release therapy, and I go to a chiropractor, and I just try to take care of myself. Recovery is going to come in the form of it's going to be 24/7, you know.
Right.
So somebody's talking about recovery, I think a lot of times people automatically think about like a foam roller or a complex unit that you put on your body or something like that. But it can come in so many different forms. It could come in your hydration, your sleep. The things that you're going to do for yourself are always going to be way superior to anything that you're going to do to yourself. And so, you know, going for a walk or riding a bike or just all these things, they're going to benefit you way, way more than going in a cryo chamber or any of those things.
I totally agree. And Mark, you've been interesting in that nutrition has historically not been a super high priority within the powerlifting world.
We like
you've really kind of sank your teeth into like the kind of paleo, low carb, even ketogenic diet stuff, which has been kind of controversial. Like I've seen some folks really go after you on this stuff. Like what's been your process with that?
I like a good fight for sure.
And you do an admirable job too. Yeah.
Yeah, I like to yell back at people sometimes. It's just fun. But, you know, first of all, I don't know if I've told you this before, but I got to start out by thanking you because you were the start of all this. You know, I did a ketogenic style diet when I was a teenager. It was the first time I ever did it back in like 1994, somewhere in that range. And then I read, you know, Body Opus, Metabolic Diet by Dr. Mauro DiPasquale, Anabolic Diet, and been on and off ketogenic style diets for a very long time. But as a power lifter and as an adult, I got up to 337 pounds. I was a big, big boy, chubby Chubberton. And, you know, as I started to consider how I was going to lose weight, I knew that I wanted to do like a keto style diet, but at the same time, I was enjoying a lot of really sweet food and stuff when I was that big. And I was enjoying smashing a lot of weights, but I also realized like, shit, man, this ain't healthy. And so your name started getting kicked around. I heard a lot about the Paleo Solution, and I was like, you know what? Maybe I should check this out, because if I just go from what I'm doing right now to just not eating any carbs, it's going to be like, I don't know, just mentally it sounds like too hard. Sounds like something I can't do. And the best diet is the one you can follow, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I looked into your book, and I was like, shit, okay, I can have some of this. I can have some of that. There's at least a little bit of carbs on the menu. And so I started doing that. And I think I lost about 40 pounds. That really helped me momentum-wise. And since that time, I haven't gotten back up over 300 pounds. And so thank you. I appreciate that. The information you put out had a really
awesome.
Huge positive impact on my life.
That's awesome. Best result, the reward I ever get is knowing that my work had some positive influence on people. So that's awesome.
And then, you know, as far as me kind of diving into the diet stuff more, just as I got deeper into my career, I recognized how important it truly is. Now, how important your diet is for performance is insanely debatable. You know, I know many, many athletes that disregard really anything nutritionally, and they run the gamut of being, you know, multiple time world champions, and they run the gamut of not looking like they work out at all, right?
Right.
So that part is very confusing. When it comes to performance, I don't really think someone can say, hey, if you eat this amount of carbs, it's going to cause this result, or if you eat this amount of fat, it's going to do this. In terms of your health and in terms of your markers for health and in terms of looking like you work out and fixing some of your aesthetics, it's very clear, you know, what the diet can do for you. And then it's very clear that the diet can help against certain diseases. And it's very clear that the diet can just make you kind of feel better overall, help you think better, and so on. So I've dove into it deeper and deeper, because what I think is the problem, what I think is where a lot of us are, I mean, and we're failing, by the way, like, just so everyone fucking understands this, fitness industry, we are losing. We are losing this battle. We're losing this fight. And there's too many people that are too fat and have too many diseases. And we're losing people every day. And I like to try to promote the fact that when I'm talking about these ketogenic style diets, low carb diets, I'm in the middle of writing a book called The War on Carbs. When I'm promoting some of this stuff and I'm talking about some of this stuff, I'm really trying to say is I'm fighting a war on addiction. It's a war on addiction, and it's a war on a surplus of junk food that surrounds us every single day. Those temptations are really, really hard to fend off, and mm-hmm. and get so used to it. Like, you know, when the fuck did macaroni and cheese become like a meal? Like, why is that an acceptable thing to just give a child? And I don't think anybody thinks about it. That's really where we're losing, is that people just aren't thinking. You know, in my household with my children, we're at least always thinking about it. You know, when we go out to dinner, my son last night, he had a Coke with his, he had a pretzel, just this awesome pretzel at this place down the street from my house. And, you know, he knows, like, you just get one, you
right.
know, you get one soda, like, that's fine. You can drink. And you know what? If it's whatever, you can have two or three, but just know what you're doing and understand what you're doing. And back it up with some exercise here and there. It's not going to kill you. My son rides his bike to and from school. Both my children end up going on the walks with me and stuff. Neither one of them were fascinated enough with sports to really get all that deep into any of that. And so they're not really into that. But I think what we're really truly up against is we're up against addiction, and the craving for sugar and the craving for carbohydrates is huge. And when you have something like pizza or something like a peanut butter cup or some of these things, they're just bursting with so much flavor that you get used to that, and then you get desensitized mm-hmm. to the flavor of something like spinach or raw almonds. But raw almonds taste fucking awesome, but they don't taste awesome anymore because we've had Big Macs and chocolate shakes and everything else.
Right,
so,
right. No, I absolutely agree. Yeah,
that's usually some of the stuff I'm trying to pitch to people and make people kind of better understand.
Hey, so Mark, what's the timeline on the book?
We've actually been cranking through it. I actually wrote another book called Jacked and Tan, and Jacked and Tan is training and nutritional advice. And I had to, that has been kind of like going on and off for the last like 2.5, 3 years. And so I had to put a kind of halt on that because that's a larger book.
Mm-hmm.
War on Carbs will probably only be about 75 pages. And I think that that book will be done by the end of this month. And, you know, I don't know the rest of the process from there because I'm publishing it myself. Doing kind of everything, you know, real grassroots over here on my own. But
nice.
Hopefully we can get it out by like November, December.
Awesome.
You know, that's what I'm hoping. And just a lot of times when you read through some of these diet books, you're like, you know, and some of these books don't really want to be a diet book per se. They want, you know, to kind of be more of a lifestyle. But a lot of times when I read through them, I'm like, where's the fucking information? Like, where's the diet? Like, I need. So we're going to address that and pretty much just give you the information flat out. And there'll be some information in there, but I'm not going to flood you with a lot of science and stuff. That's not my thing. That's not where I'm strong. And so I'm going to flood you with my experiences rather than try to, you know, pull out some studies and stuff like that.
Fantastic. You know, it's funny, if you can just get people to just do something, usually it goes pretty well. And the, you know, the internet and social media are kind of a double-edged sword because we can share so much information, but then also everybody gets in and starts fact-checking everything. And there's a contrary position to every position, every suggestion, so that you can just have this analysis paralysis and not go or do anything. So it's a tough one, which is part of the reason why in some of the stuff I've written, it's like a legal disclaimer up front. Like, I try to conceive of every possible question, qualm, and all the rest of it, but it ends up being a bastard to write something like that versus just like, hey, just do this, do it for 30 days, get back to me, and if you like the results, keep going with it. If not, there's something else you could do.
Yeah, the war on carbs actually starts off with a swearing in process.
Nice.
You know, like that. You're like, I have like a part in there where you're literally going to sign your name in there, and I'm kind of hoping that people get excited about that, and I hope they take some pictures and throw it up on social media because I do want them to really make a strong commitment. The war on carbs is no carbs. It's a ketogenic style diet through and through, and there's no end in sight. There's no cheat meal. There's no reconstituting. There's no refeed. There's no nothing. I realize that these things are going to happen, that you're going to break at some point anyway. And so therefore I don't have it. I don't say every 7 days or every 10 or whatever. I do have a period where you can, once you start to lose weight and once you become more efficient and once you're, insulin resistance isn't too out of whack, then I get you to a point where you can have some carbohydrates here and there. But I really just want to try to, the more that you abstain from it, it seems the better and the stronger. Mm-hmm. So I've been helping a lot of people lately, and the people that their cheat is something like that's not even really a cheat, those are the people that are thriving. Those are people
right.
that are doing the best, and those are people I know that I can rely on, that they're not going to end up being heavy again. You know, they're going to be able to actually physically keep that weight off. And so that's really the main thing, is like just having something that is really going to be sustainable, having something that people can follow for a period of time.
That's awesome. If you want a pre-review reader, fire it off to me. I'd love to check it out.
Absolutely, 100%. And then also my brother and I are working on a movie. And, you know, people are always asking my brother, you know, what's his next documentary and stuff like that. And so he and I are working on a film called Land of Confusion, which is basically everyone's confusion about nutrition and about health. And so we're going to obviously talk quite a bit about keto since we both do a ketogenic style diet. But we're also going to try to – we're in search of, like, the truth, and we're in search of even almost proving ourselves wrong. You know, that would be the main goal, is like, you know, are we off? Like, is this not right? Is there some better way? Is there something else that we're not doing, or is there something that we're missing? And so that's what we're going to be trying to discover. And we're going to come talk to people like yourself and other experts around the United States to try to figure out what's the most optimal.
That's awesome. And it remind me of the name of the movie again?
Land of Confusion.
Land of Confusion. Awesome. Yes, I've had some emails back and forth about that, and I'm super excited to see that one roll out. There's finally some good documentaries kind of taking this ancestral eating, low carb, even the sustainability story, you know, some of the Savory Institute stuff. There's some good films popping up on that, which is well-timed because, man, the vegans are kicking our asses on all this stuff.
Oh, my God. No.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you happen to see the study with the rats most recently with them living 13% longer?
I think it was like 20% longer. So it was interesting. So they put them on what they kind of tongue-in-cheek called a paleo-type diet. They had a standard diet, a paleo diet, and then a ketogenic diet. In the paleo-type diet, which was lower glycemic load, higher protein, they had like a 10% increase in overall lifespan. In the keto group, it was a 20% overall increase in total lifespan. And it's a really, really interesting stuff. So I kind of tinker in and out of that ketogenic state with jujitsu. I find that about 75 to 120 grams of carbs keeps me motored along pretty good. I don't feel kind of adrenalized when I'm at that level, where if I drop down to legit keto levels of like 30 to 50 grams a day, I can kind of get blown out doing, you know, 5-6 days a week at jujitsu. But I started actually testing a little bit of both the blood glucose and the ketones, and even at that level, like on a hard training day, I'm in ketosis most of the day. So kind of
yeah,
interesting.
I would imagine that you're probably not even being bumped out you know, all that often. Have you found that you get, like, if you do get bumped out or your ketones are lower, have you found that it's like sometimes a full day or day and a half later rather than, like, you know, a more immediate? Because for me, that's what I've noticed before whenever I do eat some carbs.
You know, I've been pretty consistent, interestingly, like I'm working in a pretty tight framework, and that I kind of do the same stuff. Like the training load is about the same, the food's about the same, sleep's about the same. And I don't know if I would call all of that optimized, but it's definitely at a spot where I think my body is adapted to that. And so I don't see a ton of deviation away from just this kind of baseline.
But even with your ketone production, like where is that? Like, are you still in ketosis when you're?
Yeah, it you know, 0.7 to 1.2. Yeah. Usually the 0.7 is about the lowest that it gets. But I don't check super frequently, but that's been kind of the lowest that I've seen. But that was even on a day again where I had maybe 150 grams of carbs, but it was also a day that we did 10-minute rounds for 2 hours, you know, 1 minute rest, and it wasn't a blistering pace, because you can't do a blistering pace with that, but it was a lot of work. And we have some big, strong technical dudes that I roll with, you know, and I have to be on my game for sure. And but the volume and the intensity of that I think you know, kept me in that kind of ketotic state. And that's a whole fascinating topic too. You know, the guys over at Keto Gains, they're kind of postulating that over the course of time, if your body just gets better at using fatty acids directly, then the ketone level might drop because you don't actually need that many ketones. So it's really interesting stuff.
Yeah, and they say also too, like the leaner you are, the more muscle mass you have, the ketones could be, you know, being utilized all the time. So
right.
You might not register that high. And
right.
What kind of carbs do you eat?
Oh man, you know, it's during the summer I do a little more fruit. So like I've been doing figs and watermelon and stuff like that during the summer. As it heads into the winter, I do more squash and potatoes, which doesn't take a lot to hit that that allotment. Right. And then also I get a lot of it kind of background from, like, I'll eat a lot of coconut flakes, I'll eat macadamia nuts, cashews. Mm-hmm. And so it's really slow release carbs, and I'm getting a significant whack of fat with that. And so I'll do a little bit of quicker release stuff from potatoes, sweet potatoes, fruit. But then I would say probably 50% of the carbs are things like carrots, coconut, you know, which coconut, you do a half cup of it, and I want to say it's like 22 grams of fat, 8 grams of carbs, 4 of those grams are fiber, and so it ends up being a super high fiber, you know, very moderate carb load.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Have you heard of Ray Peet before?
I have. Yeah. Yeah. And he's a super smart and super crazy both at the same time.
Yeah. He's got some really good information on fructose.
Mm-hmm.
If you just YouTube it, you can check it out. But talks about how fructose can really do some wonders for your thyroid. And
mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, my experience so far with the keto diet is that, you know, fructose seems to be like in some weird category on its own as a carbohydrate. I don't know if it would, you know, necessarily allow you to stay in ketosis if you had a lot of it, but just using some, you know, eating some oranges and some apples and some berries and things like that seem to be pretty safe even while on a ketogenic style diet.
Yeah, because that fructose kind of preferentially refills liver glycogen. But I mean, if you're otherwise pretty low carb, you know, that's a lot of fruit, particularly for someone that's reasonably muscular, reasonably, you know, active. You're talking about a lot of fruit to fully top off the liver glycogen. I think that gets a lot easier when we're talking about 72-ounce big gulps that are made up of, you know, high fructose corn syrup. That's a whole other reloading strategy.
Yeah, and that's why fructose has a bad rap, is
right.
You know, it's consumed in so many different ways.
Right. Well, hey, Mark, I want to be respectful of your time, but it's awesome reconnecting with you. Tell folks where they can track you down on the interwebs and follow what you're doing.
Yeah, actually, I'm really excited because we have revamped our website. And actually, as of later tonight, the new website gets launched and you can check it out at howmuchyoubench.net. I have the Slingshot, which is a supportive upper body device for bench press and push-ups and dips. Helps you to bench heavy without any pain and also helps to kind of put you in a lot better position in terms of technique with the bench press. Also have hip circles and knee sleeves and all kinds of other stuff on there. So check that out at howmuchyoubench.net. And then also you can find me at Mark Smelly Bell on Instagram and Twitter. In addition to that, I got my own podcast, which is called Mark Bell's Powercast. You can check that out at iTunes. And, you know, just super excited to be on the show today and fired up to get you on my show. I got a lot of questions to ask you, and I think our audience is going to really appreciate it. So thanks, man. Appreciate
awesome.
It.
Awesome. And Mark, thank you so much. You've been so incredibly kind and generous with your time and also just kind of supporting my work. So I really, really thank you for that.
Absolutely. You got great work. So it's easy to support when someone's doing well.
Thanks, man. Well, I look forward to getting down to the facility and having you do a run through my L4, L5 disc deal and see what we can come up with.
I'll just throw you in a camel clutch and that'll work.
Perfect. Hey, straight iron chic is where it's at. So I like
That's
it.
Right.
I like it. Awesome,
right,
Mark. Well, take care.
Catch you later.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks again for listening to the Paleo Solution Podcast. Here's a quick message from one of our sponsors.
You know, the true definition of sleep, circuitous, it's the lack of wakefulness, right? And you have to allow the wakefulness-promoting hormones and neurotransmitters to go away. And it's in our language. You drift off to sleep. You fall to sleep. You slide into sleep, right? You don't push a button and go, I'm on to sleep now. Like, it doesn't work that way.
That's Dr. Kirk Parsley, sleep expert and former Navy SEAL. And Doc Parsley wasn't just a SEAL. He was also the physician for the SEALs. He created the Sleep Cocktail product after years of working with SEALs suffering from chronic sleep issues. How does the Sleep Cocktail work? Let's let Doc Parsley tell us.
All my supplement does is it truly supplements, or it just supplements all of the substrates along the melatonin pathway. Gives you a really, really low dose of melatonin just to kickstart it off. So you're getting just a dusting of melatonin that's just enough to kind of help you initiate the cascade. And then I talked a little bit about GABA increasing as you go to sleep and kind of slowing down the neocortex. So there's a form of GABA in there, GABA derivative called PH-GABA, that really is just a way to get GABA to cross the blood-brain barrier so that it can actually work in the brain and the body. And that's it. I mean, that's it.
Give Doc Parsley's sleep cocktail a try. Go to robwolf.com/sleepcocktail and use code ROBWOLF10 to save 10%.